Hello and welcome to Dialogues in Dermatology. I'm Dr. Lauren Counsell, your editor-in-chief. We have another exciting podcast for you today. We hope that you enjoy. Hello and welcome to Dialogues in Dermatology. I'm Lauren Counsell, a dermatologic surgeon at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and I have the pleasure of speaking today with Dr. Jennifer Gardner, assistant professor of dermatology from the University of Washington and a collaborating member of the University of Washington Center for One Health Research. Today we're going to be speaking on the topic of veterinary dermatology. Dr. Gardner, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
First, can you tell our listeners a little bit about comparative dermatology and the One Health paradigm?
Yeah, so One Health is kind of the current buzz phrase for the concept that human health is intimately linked to animal health and the health of the shared environment. It's a phrase that also incorporates a synergistic collaboration between physicians, veterinarians, and environmental scientists and other public health workers to really bring people together in a collaborative nature for research and shared knowledge and education. It's kind of an umbrella term that incorporates a lot of other silos, such as those found in veterinary medicine and environmental health.
Interesting. Are there any conditions that may be particularly relevant to the practicing dermatologist?
Yeah, so I think the most easy one to consider are those of zoonotic conditions. And when I think about the One Health paradigm, just to back up a little bit, you can also think of it as a framework that sort of builds on the Engel's psychosocial model of disease. So looking at it from the ground up in the human world that we're most familiar with, from the molecular to the cellular to the organ level, which makes up an individual human, what we know as our patients, and of course beyond that, the family, community, and the health of the planetary society. Well, if we expand that framework into hierarchies that are very parallel within the environment and the animal worlds, we have the One Health model. It's very useful in thinking about this because it allows us to look at the work that we're doing either at the benchside in test tubes or in our petri dishes or also in our patients, in our clinics, and ask how does what we're doing right there in front of us scale up the model? What are the implications to higher level societies or planetary health? And what are those upper level factors that might be influencing health or disease? What's very powerful about the One Health framework is that you can also look to make connections horizontally. So looking at those factors both in the environment and the animal world, and looking for those connections and looking for potential collaborations that could be very powerful to look at problems and try to solve them with those shared expertise.
Can you give some examples of things that are ongoing?
Sure. So, like I said, the most easy I find to explain to people when they don't understand what One Health is the zoonotic infections. So we all think about zoonotic infections passing from animals to humans, and honestly, it goes both ways, so from humans to animals too. It also can go through vectors or fomites within the shared environment, and both from animals to humans and from humans to animals, again, through those vector sources. But it also allows us to think about the ecosystem drivers that might be affecting those players within the One Health paradigm. So if we think about that, we can think about moving global populations into the built shared environment, but also into peri-domestic environments and how we're encroaching on wildlife and what that means for potential risk for either new emerging health problems, especially with regard to zoonotic infections. If we look at climate change and how that might affect both vector distribution and spread, especially a hot topic in media right now with vector-borne diseases. And then if we look at other factors that might be encroaching on the environment as far as habitat destruction, that's going to affect your animal reservoirs. And so all of these things within the One Health paradigm can be considered and explored as far as factors that will eventually go on to affect human health and disease.
So it sounds like you're describing both conditions that affect wildlife and domesticated animals and humans. Is that correct?
Yeah, the One Health paradigm includes all of those things. It's one of the few models that actually incorporate MD physicians as part of the paradigm, in addition to wildlife workers and scientists and veterinarians and other environmental scientists. So that's why the One Health model speaks so much to me as a dermatologist.
And how does the dermatologist play a role in this research?
I think by understanding these connections, we can better help explain to patients what their risk factors are, what they mean, and what they aren't. So for instance, if you can understand those conditions that are zoonotic and also those that are not. So for instance, Demodex, which are mites, the follicle mites, of course, that live in our pores, they're very species specific, but not everyone remembers that they're not passed zoonotically. So each species, if you look in their follicles, has their own flavor of Demodex mites, from panda bears to elephants, and of course, our companion companion animals, the canines, the dogs, and the cats that live in our own homes. So it's actually a big problem as far as Demodex in canines and cats when they get over infestations with those particular mites. In humans, it's been a little less clear, but the updates are that there are some associated dermatologic conditions that can be due to our own flavor of Demodex mites. And those are things like rosacea, some hair loss. They're the acneiform eruptions to the EGFR inhibitors that we see in some of our cancer patients. So there are definitely some associations that are relevant. In human skin disease, conditions such as rosacea, where we think Demodex is playing some role for some patients, there are some great treatments out there. One of the oldest and best, of course, being sulfur. There are some newer treatments on the market, such as systemic and topical ivermectin products. Now, if we look to the veterinary world, they are at least 1 to 2 decades ahead of us in antiparasitic therapy. So that's where, though this is not a zoonotic condition, we can look to their clinics and see if there are any revolutions going on there that might one day come down the line and be good therapeutic options for human disease. So one of those options has been a big change in veterinary medicine over the last year, and that's a new class of medication that's helping to treat Demodex in dogs and cats. Like I said, this is a major problem clinically in that population, and it can really have a huge impact on the health and well-being of those animals and their households, including their human companions. So traditionally, they've been using Amitraz and more recently the ivermectins off-label to treat that condition and related compounds. But that problem is it takes many, many months for treatment, and there are some potential toxicities. Additionally, some of the dogs have genetic mutations that allow for the problem with the metabolism of that drug, and it's not a safe option at all. That allows only for skin-directed therapies like dips and shampoos, which is not a very effective treatment strategy for patients who are covered in fur. Luckily, in the human dermatology world, we don't have that problem. But the revolution that's occurred in the last year is actually a new class of antiparasitic medications called the isozazolines, and it's a GABA receptor antagonist. There are about 4 on the market now, 3 oral preparations and 1 topical, and they're approved currently for the treatment of anti-tick and anti-flea medications. But as it turns out, off-label, it's been really revolutionizing treatment for the Demodex mites that are seen in dogs and cats, and the treatment courses are much shorter, much more effective, and it's really found a solution for that problem.
Is anyone looking into these in humans?
I don't know of any current studies that are being done or clinical trials, but my suspicion is that's going to be coming down the line. And I don't think we would know that that was the case unless we really looked over just basically across the street to see what are happening right now in the veterinary clinics in our own households, truly, for our own dogs and cats.
That's very interesting. Do you have other examples of things that we've learned from our veterinary colleagues?
Sure. So another construct or idea in the One Health paradigm is this idea of looking at large animal models of human disease. So this is what I call beyond the mousetrap. And these are basically non-murine or non-mouse models of disease that we can use to study and learn about human diseases. That includes skin diseases. So usually it's large animal. We're talking about dogs, cats, ferrets, sometimes horses. One of the big large animal models of disease that I think is most applicable currently is that of canine atopic dermatitis. It's really been worked out with excellent studies to show that canine atopic dermatitis is a naturally occurring and homologous entity to human atopic dermatitis. And that is in its similarities to prevalence, genetic predispositions, barrier dysfunctions, immunology, and finally, we are seeing similarities in the changes within their microbiome. So there's been an excellent study out of a beautiful One Health collaboration between Dr. Charles Bradley. He's a veterinary dermatopathologist. He works at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Elizabeth Grice, who is a PhD and a superstar microbiome researcher currently at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Dermatology. They collaborated to look at the changes in the cutaneous microbiome in dogs who had atopic dermatitis and showed a very similar picture to what has been shown in the cutaneous microbiome in pediatric atopic dermatitis, delineated by Dr. Heidi Kong's lab. It's very exciting to see similar changes in pre-flare, flare, and post-treatment states on the skin, essentially resulting in a decreased diversity of the cutaneous microbiome overall during pre-flare and flare states with an overabundance of staph species. The big difference, and and then after treatment, having a restoration of that biodiversity. That's the exact same changes that we see in the pediatric atopic dermatitis microbiome when that has been studied. And the only big difference there is that in dogs, it's Staph pseudointermedius that is the issue. And that's, of course, the type of Staph that increases its abundance in flare states. In humans, of course, it's the good old Staph aureus that we all know and love.
What are some of the advantages of using these animal models for studies?
Yeah, so I mean, that just opens the door for translational research. One problem with the mouse models is that usually it's a genetic change that results in a phenotype that looks similar to human disease. But if you look out in mouse communities, they aren't actually running around with atopic dermatitis. So we're sort of inflicting something that's not naturally found in nature. As it turns out, it's just a matter of asking the question, did dogs get atopic dermatitis? And then looking into the veterinary world to see what the answer is. Of course, that answer is yes, as I've already told you. But that has huge implications. There has a lot of advantages too, because it's a complex disease that's probably better understood in a model such as this. It also shares same environment as humans who would be up against some of those environmental risk factors that would influence whether they get atopic dermatitis as well. We're in fact sharing the same households, the same communities, so it has a really big advantage on that front. The other advantage and the difference it has between looking at large animal models of disease in, say, clinical trials looking at treatment strategies versus the mouse models is that it really has the opportunity to treat not just humans down the road, but also the canines themselves. So this approach has the benefit of potentially improving the health of both species, and that's a win-win.
So you've mentioned a few really excellent studies and some conditions that we've learned from our veterinarian colleagues. What can our average listener, maybe someone in private practice, how can the average dermatologist get involved in these sort of initiatives?
Well, I think one way to do that is just considering how to increase their knowledge of when to talk to your patients about whether that you think there could be a link to the condition you're seeing there in the clinic on their skin to something that's going on either in their environment or perhaps an animal within their environment. And when it's appropriate, just consider picking up the phone and talking to the family veterinarian about what you're seeing there in the dermatology clinic and improving that communication across those disciplines. I think that has a huge impact on how we treat our patients and looking at their shared household environment. Because as we know, sometimes you can treat what you see in the clinic, but there's more to the story. And often that involves a One Health approach.
Are there anything exciting coming down the pipeline?
Well, I would say also looking at canine atopic dermatitis as a model for human atopic dermatitis, we're about to see an explosion, as we all know, in systemic targeted therapies for that disease in humans. And as it turns out, the vets are about 5 to 6 years ahead of us on that front too. So thinking about it as a homologous model of disease, I think we can ask them what their experience is and learn from that so we can anticipate some things that we might see in our own patients as we start to get some experience using those therapies as well.
That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing with our listeners both background about what One Health is and what we can also do to become more aware of these. Do you have any final thoughts with what you'd like to leave our listeners?
Lauren, I think that was great. Thank you so much for being interested in One Health. And I think there's a lot to learn. I think it's a very powerful framework in which we can all come together from different disciplines and expertise to really look at an old question, but really work together to find new and important answers.
Thank you.